Proud to say we've got a new sponsor this week, Casper Mattresses, along with two other great sponsors, Audible. And of course, don't forget, with Audible, you can get a free book with your 30-day free trial by going to www.audible.com/undisclosed. And finally, Blue Apron. Listen in for the spots later in the show. Until then, enjoy.
Starting on January 12, 2000, the Rome Police Department was in charge of the investigation into the murder of Isaac Dawkins. Based upon misinformation about an alleged shooting 6 months earlier, Joey Watkins soon became the prime suspect. But based upon an inability to find evidence against him, such as evidence tying him to the car used by the shooter or the likely murder weapon, he was soon written off as a suspect. Joey Watkins, however, was far from the only suspect investigated by the Rome Police Department, and questions remain today about whether we can write off those suspects as well. Hi, and welcome to episode 7 of Undisclosed. Today's episode is The Unusual Suspects. I'm Colin Miller, Associate Dean and Professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. I also blog at Evidence Prof Blog. As always, I'm joined by my colleagues, Rabia Chowdhury. Rabia is an attorney and fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Susan Simpson. Susan is an attorney at the Volkov Law Group, and she blogs at The View from L2. In Jones v. State, the Court of Appeals of Georgia noted that, as a general rule, a defendant may introduce evidence which tends to show that another person committed the crime with which he is charged. Such evidence, however, must be otherwise admissible, and its probative value must not be outweighed by the likelihood that it will cause undue delay, prejudice, or confusion. Specifically, this evidence must be relevant to the accused's trial, show facts inconsistent with the accused's own guilt, and raise a reasonable inference or presumption as to his own innocence. Such evidence must also directly connect the third party with the crime at issue and point clearly to the third party's guilt. Evidence which can have no other effect than to cast a bare suspicion on another or to raise a conjectural inference as to the commission of the crime by another is not admissible. You can understand why Georgia courts would want evidence directly connecting a third party to a crime before a defendant can present it to a jury. We don't want defendants to be able to defame the good names of the innocent, and we don't want jurors to be confused by a bevy of the usual suspects. On the other hand, Georgia courts have consistently said that circumstantial evidence, even in the absence of direct evidence, is sufficient to support a jury's finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So, is it fair to hold defendants to a higher burden than the state?
Especially considering the fact that defense counsel is not going to have the same powers that the state has to conduct an investigation and find that kind of evidence.
At the same time, I mean, in this case, it's a good example. If the defense had been able to point to every suspect there was, well, that would have led a lot of confusion on the jury's part because there were a lot of suspects. And a lot of them had plausible-sounding reasons to be looked into. But for purposes of investigation and for our podcast, I think it's important to see what the Rome police did and who they looked at before the Floyd County police settled on Joey.
So as we mentioned before, once the Floyd County Police Department got involved in the case, there were no other suspects but Joey. Joey and a to-be-determined accomplice were always the target, and the only one. But in the first 7 weeks of the case, during the Rome Police Department's investigation, other suspects were pursued, and other leads were followed. Some of these alleged suspects were known by the defense, and they were actually raised either at the trial and post-conviction, while others were just footnotes in the case that the defense never thought were worth pursuing, or they never knew about in the first place.
I mean, from the outset, this was going to be a hard case to investigate. Other than Joey, there was no suspect at first because Isaac, he seemed like an unlikely person to be the victim of violent crime. He had no history of drugs or criminal activity, no obvious generalized risk factors, and a lot of people in his life seemed to have been unaware of any issues he might have had with anyone, including Joey. For instance, here's a note taken by Mosier when he spoke to Joy Bowden, one of Isaac's ex-girlfriends. She said she talked to Isaac on Monday, the day before he died, that evening, in fact. And Isaac gave no indication of any problems with anyone. In fact, Joy Bowden had never heard Isaac mention any problems with Joey or Paul Allen. Now, the reason Mosier was asking about that, we know why he's asking about Joey. But Paul Allen, was, at the beginning, the other suspect in this case.
Yeah, so while Joey was one of the earliest suspects in Isaac's death, he wasn't necessarily the first. Because at the same time that Detective Moser was attempting to track down and interview Joey, he was also pursuing another teenager as a subject of interest, and that was Paul Allen. Now, Paul had been one of Joey's close friends, although they weren't as close at the time that this all happened. Now, Paul wasn't a suspect because of anything having to do with Joey. It was because the rumor was that Paul and Isaac had bad blood between them as a result of Paul recently dating Isaac's sister, Samantha. In fact, sometime in the fall of 1999, Samantha had actually moved in with Paul against her family's wishes. And although the rumors are of a dubious origin, the word around town was that a few days before Isaac's death, Isaac had confronted Paul at his house and had taken his sister back home. And according to witnesses at the hospital the night that Isaac was shot, Paul drove a black Camaro. Now, of course, that's not a Honda, but it's at least closer to a Honda than a white truck. So on January 13th, a couple of days after Isaac was shot, Detective Moser interviewed Paul. And it wasn't just as a witness. Paul, in fact, was given his Miranda warnings. He was interviewed as a potential suspect in the case. In response to the interrogation, Paul told Moser that he hadn't known Isaac well, but they were friendly enough and they had hung out, which they sometimes did on account of their girlfriends being best friends. Now, Paul denied he'd ever had any bad words with Isaac. He said he didn't know him that well. They'd talk sometimes, but they never had any words, never had any problems. And besides, he had an alibi for the night of the shooting.
So Paul's alibi was just a little bit loosey-goosey. It changed a bit as things went on, and the timings got a little more favorable to him. But still, it's clear that at some point that night, not too long after the murder took place, he was in Northwest Rome because he was changing a tire for his aunt, Cricket. Paul remained at the periphery of the investigation. He wasn't seriously considered as a suspect, but he was never actually cleared either. And back in the months immediately after Isaac's death, one of the more common rumors going around was that Joey and Paul had committed the murder together. Here's Jessica, Brianne's friend, talking about something she'd heard.
All right, you said that you had heard some other rumors throughout the community.
Mm-hmm.
All right, can you tell me the rumor, and one of the rumors you had, you mentioned to me, you might have told Stanley some more, but one of the rumors you said was about Joey and Paul Allen. Tell me that story and tell me who you got it from, and all, just in your own words.
I went into work one day, and a girl that I worked with named Tiffany was there. She came up to me and was like, "I know who killed Isaac." And I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "There were two guys in here talking about their friend Paul that was sitting in a car when Joey and Isaac got into an argument outside Isaac's truck, and Joey shot the gun to scare him, but it accidentally hit him."
All right. Okay, this conversation took place where?
American Eagle.
American Eagle. All right, and that's between you and Tiffany.
Mm-hmm.
And Tiffany's last name is?
I think Ford and Mary.
Okay. All right, and she told you, how did she learn that information?
There were two guys talking about it in the store.
Who were those two guys?
I have no idea. She didn't know.
She didn't know. All right. And she said that Joey had the weapon.
Yes, sir.
Eventually, Paul and Joey both began circulating rumors that the other one had done it. And actually, both of them were getting their rumors from the same source, a guy named Josh Flemister. And both Paul and Joey would believe him, which was kind of a stupid move on both of their parts. But Josh would go to Joey and tell him about how Paul had confessed that he'd done the murder. And then Josh would run and go say the reverse story to Paul and his friends. And both Paul and Joey believed Josh's stories about the other guy. Because, I mean, anything to get the police off their backs, right? And Stanley Sutton was pretty relentless. So if someone was telling you who the real murderer was, wouldn't you point that way too, just to get the heat off of you? Because for a while, Joey really did think that Paul might have done it.
Do you remember Josh's stories about Paul? And of recording?
Not really. Oh, yeah. Yes, I do. I do remember that. You're talking about the tape recorder that I had under my seat.
You really had one under your seat?
I really had one. Josh kept telling me that Paul had something to do with this. Paul did this. Paul said he did it. He admitted to doing this. Blah, 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 blah. So I ended up going and getting Paul. I called Paul and I was like, "Look, man, I want to talk to you." And he was like, "Cool, what's up?" And I was like, "Let's just meet up and you know, we'll go off, we'll do something. So I ended up picking him up instead of going to his house because his mom and them didn't like me and my mom and dad didn't like him. I ended up going and picking him up at the Dempsey Dairy, a little turnaround right there. He walked up there, and me and Paul actually went to Buckhead that night. And the whole way there, I had a little recording up under my seat. And, you know, I kind of nonchalantly, we would talk about the investigation and this and that and the other with Isaac and deal with Isaac. And Paul was kind of, he wouldn't talk about it. When I asked him where he was at and what he was driving that night, and I kept telling him what I kept hearing. And the only thing that he would admit was that he was driving Samantha's car that night, and Samantha was in his car. Samantha and Brianne were supposedly at a basketball game. This is what Paul told me. Samantha and Brianne were supposedly at a basketball game, and him and Chad and somebody else were in Samantha's car.
Did you keep that recording?
Unfortunately, Josh Flemister ended up with it.
Wait, how'd that happen?
After that happened, like 2 or 3 days later, I went to Josh's house, and Josh said, "Let me see the recorder. I'm going to talk to Paul. I'm going to try to get to scare him into telling me what really happened." So I gave Josh the recorder, and Josh was supposedly going to get a confession out of Paul. Well, I went to Josh's house like 2 or 3 weeks later, and that's when Josh was laid out on the floor on pills, passed out. And I'm out telling his dad, and I can't even wake him up. He's barely breathing. And I went back home. I told my mom what was going on. And then went back to Josh's house, and his grandparents had got him, and I think they took him to the hospital. So when he recovers, he don't know what happened to the recording.
No.
So.
Now, Paul, of course, returned the favor to Joey. He's the one that reports Josh's stories to Sutton in November, which leads to Joey's arrest a few days later. And he testified against Joey at trial, adding embellishments to his stories that were really damaging to Joey.
When I met with Paul, or rather, surprised him at his workplace at the end of a shift, he was a bit surprised to find out who I was when I introduced myself. But he was friendly and willing to talk, and unlike the vast majority of the state's witnesses, he didn't tell me to fuck off when I explained what I was there for. He was very curious about Joey's case, but seemed deeply uncertain of what to think about it. In fact, if I phrased the question in a way that seemed to express doubt about Joey's conviction, he would usually jump back with an anecdote about how Brianne had driven Joey crazy and how he probably should have tried to claim an insanity defense on the basis of that. But if I phrased the question in a way that expressed doubts in Joey's innocence, Paul would surprise me by jumping in to try and contradict me, saying that, you know, it wasn't like that. Or that Joey wasn't anything like what he's being made out. He wasn't that bad. It wasn't the way he was being portrayed. I spoke to him for probably half an hour, and I never could get him to express a firm opinion, one way or the other, as to whether he thought Joey was guilty or innocent. Joey's opinion on Paul, though, is a little bit less ambiguous.
I talked to Paul, too.
Paul who?
Alan.
I'm sorry.
What? He was actually really nice. You know, I thought he was one of the more interesting people I've talked to, because he seems so conflicted about you. And his one of his workmates was there, and whenever someone would make a comment like, "Oh yeah, Joey was really bad" or something, he'd be the one to be like, "Oh no, man, he wasn't that bad. It wasn't like that."
Yeah. I don't know. It's, you know, if people don't know me, what they hear about me, they form an opinion, and it kind of sticks.
Yeah, I was just surprised me to see Paul Allen to be one of the ones who was pushing back against it.
He must feel bad. But with Paul, you know, Paul was, like I said, he was like my little brother, man. I love Paul to death. If you mess with Paul when we were younger, you had to mess with me. And, you know, hopefully one day, you know, I can look him face to face and, you know, tell him, "Hey, man, you know, I forgive you." But Paul did lie, and Paul did help do this to me.
Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven, inflated prices. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper in the U.S. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foams for a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature through the night. Now, mattresses can often cost well over $1,500, but Casper mattresses start at $500 for a twin-size mattress. Better yet, buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns in the U.S. and Canada with a 100-night home trial. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend one-third of your life on it. Recently, Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015, and in fact, it's now the most awarded mattress of the decade. I can say from my own experience, I've been sleeping on the Casper mattress recently. It's really comfortable, it keeps me cool, I sleep well through the night, I don't feel sore or achy in the morning. And now, Undisclosed listeners, special offer. You can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/undisclosed and entering the promo code undisclosed. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/undisclosed and entering the promo code undisclosed.
It's not that I don't understand Joy's point of view. I have a more charitable view of Paul than he does. Yes, Paul testified about some things at Joy's trial that weren't exactly true, but the things he stretched were minor in comparison to some other testimony in the case. And Paul had a lot more at stake than did any of the other kids caught up in this mix, because in a parallel universe, I think it's possible that Paul could have ended up where Joey is now, for all the same wrong reasons. And yeah, Paul was running around accusing Joey of murder on very flimsy evidence, but Joey was doing the same thing to Paul in return.
Yeah, I don't know.
He told me that if he was lucky that there was a video surveillance of him changing his aunt's tire, or else he'd have gotten in deeper than he did. I don't think there was a video.
There's not a video.
Yeah, I didn't think there was either.
Yeah, that's BS.
Yeah.
See, Paul, I don't know. You know, it's kind of a... I don't know.
Yeah.
I just know when all the heat came down, they all pointed the finger at me.
And you pointed at him.
Yeah. I did.
And okay, yes. Either in the past 16 years, Paul has invented a more favorable memory to explain why he had an alibi, are just straight up lying to me, because no, there was no video surveillance footage of him changing his Aunt Cricket's tire. But while things worked out better for Paul in the end, he still had to deal with being the runner-up suspect in the murder case for over a year. Which is probably why I feel sympathetic towards Paul. It really isn't hard to imagine a world where it's Paul locked up for killing his ex-girlfriend's brother in a rage over Isaac coming between him and Samantha. And a world where I'd be ambushing Joey at work one day and having him tell me stories about how, yeah, I remember Paul. I'm not sure to think of his case, but if it hadn't been for that girl, I bet we'd still be hanging out today.
Now, while Paul was a clear, identifiable person who was a suspect in the investigation into Isaac's death, our next alternate suspect is someone without a face or a name, and we're going to refer to this person as Isaac's doppelganger. During the Rome Police Department's investigation, they came across rumors and potential leads pointing in all directions, but one of these that's especially interesting occurred on January 12, 2000, the day that Isaac died, and Detective Moser took the following notes after talking to Isaac's mother. Quote, according to Mom, V stopped by RPD months ago, truck searched, wrong truck, Mom thinks mistake made by shooter. So that gives you the general gist of this theory. It's that Rome police officers pulled over Isaac's truck months before the shooting, and they searched it because they mistook it for a truck that was driven by someone apparently involved in criminal behavior. And so you can imagine what might have happened here if someone driving a similar-looking truck was involved in nefarious activities. It's possible that not only the police, but a potential shooter on January 11th might have seen the truck, thought Isaac was someone else, and might have shot at him in the truck. So nothing too concrete here, but certainly an interesting possibility of Isaac being mistaken from someone else and that person being the target of the shooting.
And then there is the person that Isaac possibly thought was following him. If Isaac's death was a case of mistaken identity, the same thinking might explain the following. According to Moser's notes, in January 15th, 2000, 4 days after Isaac was shot, he spoke with someone named Ms. Newland. The identity is not really clear. But according to Ms. Newland, Isaac had told her, not long before his death, that he thought he was being followed while driving in his truck, but he didn't know who the person following him was. In fact, Isaac had told Ms. Newland that he'd actually written down the car's license plate number, but she didn't know the number. A few days later, Isaac's parents called Moser and told him that they had found a notepad in Isaac's room with a note written on it. It said, red neon sport with blue stripe, and had a license plate number on it, although they couldn't tell if one of the letters was a T or a J. So Moser looked up both licenses, and while the T version brought up someone who didn't seem to have any possible connection with Isaac, the J version actually belonged to a family who lived not far from the Dawkins in Armurchie, and who had a 15-year-old son that was a student at Armurchie High School, which Isaac used to attend. So Moser ended up talking to people about the student, and the notes he has say things like the student was on medication, he was weird, and he would look right through you. And then he interviewed his mother, and the notes there say, quote, son not violent, dash, ADD. The notes also seem to indicate that Dawkins was a patient of the student's mother, who was a nurse. The notes say, quote, victim was patient, question mark. So we're not going to use the student's name because this is all too speculative, but still, it is a confusing issue in the case. Why did Isaac think he was being followed? And did he really think the 15-year-old from Armurchie had been the one following him? Newland wasn't the only one that Isaac had reported this to, by the way.
And then we have statements from Isaac's best friend, Jay Barnett. He also mentions that Isaac had concern about being followed, although in Jay's 2001 statement, it seems that Isaac's concerns were directly related to Joey.
But apparently what you're telling me that Isaac felt like he was threatened, and apparently if he was going to get a gun,
right?
Did he elaborate on that or anything?
Well, I'd asked him one night. We were coming back from a party, and I saw it in there, and I think it was like a 380. Loosen or something like that, and I'd asked him, you know, why'd he keep that in his truck, and he said just in case, and then I was like, well, in case what? And he's like, well, he's like, I don't know, I just want one in here. And he's like, well, you carry one. And I was like, well, I said, yeah, but I said, I don't really never give it a second thought. And I said, and all of a sudden you start carrying one. And then he kept saying, you just never know what some people are going to do. And then I was like, well, you talking about Joey? And he was like, well, I don't know. He's like, he's crazy enough to, but I don't know if he ever would or not. And I said, well, that was about the same time that Isaac had started talking to me about breaking up with Brianne because of all this.
Next, we'll have, as an alternate suspect, the person referred to as the Kingston Bypass Shooter. And that's because there's a series of unexplained shootings at moving vehicles that occurred in the month before and after Isaac's murder. All of them seem to be clustered around the East Rome Bypass, though, and not Highway 27, but beyond that, there are some eerie similarities to the shooting of Isaac Dawkins. So here are a couple of the shootings. On December 27th, 1999, at 6 o'clock p.m., we have the above victim was traveling west on Kingston Road in a 1990 Chevy truck when someone threw or maybe shot an object at his vehicle and shattered the right side of his windshield. He further states he heard what appeared to be a gunshot coming from a wooded area just off Kingston Road near Georgia 1. The area was checked, nothing or no one was found. Next, we have this report from January 2nd, 2000, so about 9 days before Isaac was shot, 7:08 p.m., so similar to the time of the Isaac Dawkins shooting. This says, complainant states the on or about date and time and above location, someone threw a rock from the side of the road, striking and busting the passenger side window of his white 93 Nissan pickup.
Now, it's not clear exactly why the January 2nd complainant thought that someone had thrown a rock at him as opposed to someone shooting at him. I mean, that's a busy section of the road he was on. It's not really a place that kids would be hanging out, and he didn't see any kids. So either someone had a really strong arm and really good aim, or he just didn't identify as a gunshot, which, on the face of it, seems more likely to me. And then there's a third incident. This one was much later. It was on February 26 and took place about 11:30 p.m., or at least it was reported at 11:30 p.m. The report says, on the date and time above, I was dispatched to Georgia Loop 1 and Highway 411 to make contact with the victim, who stated that while heading east on Georgia Loop at the YMCA fields just west of the first bridge, an unknown subject shot at her vehicle, which was a 95 Toyota Corolla, green in color. The subject busted out the passenger side window and put a dent in the passenger side rear, just right of the rear window. The police canine Kilo was used to try and find the suspect, but the subject was not found. And there's also a second report that says the second vehicle involved in the shooting was a 2000 green Toyota Tacoma. This vehicle was being driven by another individual, and the passenger window was shattered. I actually spoke to the woman who was involved in the February 26th incident, the one who was driving the little green car. And it seems absolutely clear from talking to her that this was a gunshot. This was not rocks. Somehow rocks weren't thrown to hit the cars three times. She could hear a shot. She couldn't see anyone. But there was a big field there that in the dark you couldn't see that well. And that's all we know at this point. There was someone in the field, definitely shot at her. And it's very close to where the other two motorists reported that they had their windows busted out and one reported hearing a gunshot. What I also find interesting, though, is that every single incident involved a pickup truck, and at least one of them was white. That was the January 2nd one, which was a pretty similar model to what Isaac was in. Now, it's Georgia, so it's a high percentage of pickup trucks anyway, but it is weird, and I think it's mostly weird because of the lack of interest in it. You'd think that if there were three possible shootings and, like, two basically confirmed shootings in the same stretch of road in a two-month span, people would be taking that seriously, but as far as I can tell, it was only looked into because of Isaac's case and then dismissed pretty quickly.
Were there any ballistics recovered from the other two shootings, like a gun or like bullets that could be matched?
No, nothing I found.
But this lady you spoke to, who's positive it was a gunshot, there was no actual bullet found in her car, is what you're saying?
No, they had the window shattered and they had the dent in the part of the car behind the window, but that was it.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the introduction, it's one of those things where there's not direct evidence linking this possible other shooter to Isaac's shooting, but, you know, there's something in evidence law known as the doctrine of chances, and that's, you know, what are the odds that you have this number of shootings of people in white trucks in the same general area and it's not the same person? I would have to think the odds are pretty low. You know, I don't know that this is anything specific that points away from Joy, but it's certainly something that is interesting and I wish had been investigated more.
Yeah, if Isaac had been shot on the East Rim bypass, if they'd looked at Joey, that would have been insane. But Isaac was not shot on this highway. He was shot to the south, about maybe 6 minute drive away, 7 minute drive away on Highway 27. So it's not the same place where these reports were being made.
Moving on to the next possible alternate suspect, this is a woman by the name of Beth Lambert, and her nickname is Loco, so this is Beth Loco Lambert. And the fascinating thing here is she supposedly confessed to Isaac's murder. Specifically, on January 15th, 4 days after Isaac was shot, the police received a call from a woman by the name of Sandra Stokes, and she said that a woman named Elizabeth Loco Lambert had been bragging about committing the murder. Now, the tip also said that she'd been staying at the Rome Motel But when they went to check out, they found out that Beth Elizabeth had skipped out in her bill on January 13th and hadn't been back. So eventually, on January 26th, the police went to interview Sandra. Sandra told Detective Moser that Beth had been drunk at the time Sandra heard her confess to, or rather brag about, the murder of Isaac. So here are some notes from that interview.
Beth was drunk. Sandra heard her say, "I got me one." Beth bragging about what she heard. "I told you I was going to get one. Shot him and he ran off the road." The notes go on to read, "Queen folks, coming up highway. Was coming up road. Shot towards rear window. White female, 132. Old blue car, 140.
In other words, Sandra was saying that Beth had committed the murder in order to advance in rank in her gang, which is part of the Folk Nation. Now, later that same day, Detective Mosier did follow up with Loco, or, well, Beth. But from the transcripts, I kind of get the feeling he wasn't taking it all that seriously.
Here's what the transcript says. Mosier: "Now, are you a member of any gang?" Lambert: "No, I'm not a member of a gang." Mosier: "Do you want to be a member?" Lambert: "Uh-uh." Mosier: "Okay, do you pretend to anybody that you are a member?" Lambert: "No." Mosier: "Not at all? You know what a queen is?" Lambert: "Uh-huh." Mosier: "Okay, you ever said anything about wanting to become a queen?" Lambert: "No." Mosier: "Are you familiar with what initiation different gangs may have?" Lambert: "Uh-huh."
So Mosier goes on to ask her if she's heard about any initiations that are necessary to get higher up in a gang, or having to shoot someone to get higher up. And Beth says, "Well, I've heard about, you know, different organizations. They might do something like that. But hers never did." And she insists that having violence to initiate someone would be a violation. So Mosier asks her, "What type of initiation would you go through in your organization?" And she says, "Well, you know, they would be sat down and talked to and asked questions to get a feel for them and what their values and stuff were, what their morals were like." And Mosier starts quizzing her about what morality and gang life is like. Although Beth insists that it's not a gang. It's an organization. Much better word. She won't tell Mosier the name of it, but she denies being a queen, says she doesn't want to be a queen, because that comes with certain responsibilities that she doesn't want to take.
So Mosier asks, "So is your organization friendly?" And Lambert says, "Yeah." And Mosier says, "Well, give me an idea of what your organization would want to accomplish." Lambert responds, basically the mental, physical, and economical growth of our people, of our organization." Eventually, Mosier gets to the point. "So, this is all in confidence, us talking about hanging out, you know, around the motels. Do you..." And Lambert says, "I don't hang around motels. I took Kent out there to see his girlfriend, and we ended up getting in a fight with her." So Mosier says, "Oh yeah, which, did she, he's, who's his girlfriend?" And Lambert says, "Sandra Stocks."
Ah, there we go. So according to Beth, she'd had a fight with Sandra on the 14th, which ended with Sandra promising to get Beth back. Beth says that the next day, somebody came and told her that Sandra had called the police on her and told the police that Beth had shot someone. And according to Beth, her reaction was that she didn't care. "I mean, I haven't done anything. It kind of upset me that she would, you know, just get dirty like that, because I think that's kind of a low blow." But, and Mosier asks her when she's talking about killing somebody, and she says, "Yeah, that's kind of, you know, but I haven't done anything, so I'm not really worried about it."
And Beth was also able to name someone else, she said, who could verify her alibi. All in all, it seemed like the story just didn't check out. Still, there is one thing that's kind of interesting. On January 10th, the day before Isaac's death, Beth bought a new car, a blackish-bluish Delta 88. Not exactly an Accord and not exactly small, but if the cops had ended up deciding on Beth as their suspect, you know that coincidence would have been the keystone of the case against her. We are going to take a short break right now to check in with one of our sponsors this week, Audible.com. And as many of you know, Audible is a leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. Audible's content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks and other audio products. And when I say unmatched, I'm talking about tens of thousands of titles. And not just an incredible selection, but a huge selection across every genre imaginable. So whether you like history, news, politics, comedy, crime writing, romance, name it, it's there. And if you become a member, you get one free audiobook every single month, and you get 30% off all regularly priced audiobooks, as well as unlimited access to their channel's content. And what's great is you can access it across a variety of platforms. There's apps for your iPhone, iPad, Android, Windows. And unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. Once you download them, they're all yours. And your library gives you access to your books anytime, anywhere, right from your smartphone or tablet. And guess what? They also have a great listen guarantee. If you didn't like it, if you didn't like what you picked, your selections, you could actually swap them out. So Audible is giving our listeners a great offer. They're going to give our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. If you go to audible.com/undisclosed and you browse like the huge selection of audio programs, you can download whatever title for free and start listening immediately. So what title would I recommend? Well, why not Adnan's Story, the book that I wrote, along with Adnan, who provided content for the book as well. Adnan's Story has been topping the charts. It's a New York Times bestseller now, but even in Audible, ever since it's released, it's been one of their top sellers for the last couple of weeks. So I would highly encourage you to take a listen, whether or not you've listened to Serial, whether or not you've listened to all of Undisclosed. Believe it or not, even having listened to everything, there's still so much to the story that you haven't heard. And it's getting great reviews, both critical reviews and listener reviews. You get to listen to it for free if you sign up for audible.com and take advantage of our offer. And let me repeat what that offer is. Again, you go to audible.com/undisclosed, sign up, browse the unmatched selection of audio programs, and get Adnan's Story for free. Let me know what you think of it.
And then we have Stanley Brummett. He's only known from Mosher's notes. There's a fair few references to him, and it was something that Mosher checked out, but we don't know anything beyond what's written there. It seems that it was known that Stanley Brummett was mentally ill and had a reputation for road rage, and apparently, allegedly, owned a 9mm. Now, it seems like it came to the attention of the cops because on several occasions in late 99, early 2000, before and after Isaac's murder, Brummett had pulled a knife on Sears store employees up in Mount Berry Square. And then on the morning of February 26, he actually pulled a knife on a Sears store employee that he ran into at Bojangles. And when the Sears employee left, Brummett was overheard threatening to cut the employee's head off. So the police were called. Brummett was told to stay away from Sears. Brummett said, "You can't make me. I'm going to be there anyway." Not sure what happened with the Sears or Bojangles issues, but for unknown reasons, Mosher's notes seem to link Brummett to the bypass shootings. There's no indication of why, or like, other than the date, I guess, of February 26, why Mosher thought Brummett might have been involved there. But he was looked into as a possible suspect in Isaac's death, until his friend Pete Powell gave him an alibi for the time of the shooting. Pete says that he was with Stanley Brummett at the time of the shooting. In fact, he was at Stanley's apartment a little bit north of where Isaac's wreck happened. And in fact, when he left Stanley's house at about 7:30, he drove past the white truck wrecked in the woods. So Stanley Brummett had an alibi. It seemed like it was not related, probably wasn't. But I did find one thing that was kind of interesting. He was arrested in 2008 for pulling a gun on another motorist in a road rage incident while driving a red Honda Accord. There's no indication if he had the Honda Accord back in 2000, but if Benson really is colorblind, well, could he have mistaken a red Honda Accord for a blue one? Maybe. But beyond Mosher's notes, we have no information on Stanley Brummett or Pete Powell, and both have now passed away, so it's not clear if there's anywhere else to take this lead.
I mean, I would say he seems to have a very clear alibi, and whether his car is red or there's even color blindness involved, it just seems like it wouldn't even matter.
Yeah, but the alibi is his friend, who conveniently was very close to the wreck at the time of the wreck. So probably not related, but I still want to know why Mosher thought he might have been involved in the other roadside shootings.
Next, we have the curious case of Joseph Boyd. In April 2000, 3 months after Isaac's death and 14 months before Joey went to trial, James Hudgens, a preacher and longtime Floyd County resident, went to talk to Rome Police Detective Jim Mosher about the case. And what he told Mosher was pretty interesting. According to Hudgens, his neighbor Joseph Boyd had confessed to fatally shooting Dawkins because he was dating Boyd's ex-wife. Boyd also added that he lived about 1 to 2 miles away from the murder scene and had heard a single gunshot from the Boyd property on January 11th, 2000, although he can't remember when it was fired. Mosher followed up by interviewing a few people, such as Boyd's ex-wife and son, as well as Isaac's friend Jay Barnett, and Boyd's ex-wife and son denied knowing Dawkins, but the son did acknowledge that his dad had guns and used to shoot them on his property. Barnett also said that his friends and he had not heard of Miss Boyd or any relationship she might have had with Dawkins. In the end, Mosher wrote up a 2 to 3 sentence report about Hudgens' statement, but it was never passed along to the district attorney or the defense.
So 13 months later, and 1 month before Joey's trial, Hudgens, the preacher, apparently decided to check into what had or hadn't happened with the statement. So he went to talk to Hal Golden, an assistant district attorney in Floyd County. Golden's recollection of this conversation matches up with Hudgens' own recollection. Hudgens told Golden that he'd had a conversation with his neighbor, Joseph Boyd or John Boyd. He goes by both names. And according to Hudgens, Boyd told him that he, quote, killed that boy down on the highway, end quote, because he was dating his ex-wife. Hudgens also told Golden that he'd had some problems with Boyd because Boyd had killed some of his guinea fowls. But Hudgens also reported that Boyd told him he'd been saved, meaning that Hudgens, as a licensed minister, forgave him. Like Mosher, Golden did not pass on this information to the defense. Finally, about 2 weeks after Joey was convicted of murdering Isaac, Hudgens told the same information to Assistant DA Steve Cox and Tammy Colston. After the interview, Cox immediately passed along this information to the defense, and Stanley Sutton interviewed Hudgens. Here's the audio of Sutton interviewing Hudgens in August of 2001.
Mr. Hudgens, just tell me, since we're on tape, you understand we're on tape, just tell me everything that you know about this Dawkins case, how you began to learn about this case.
Well, I began to learn about it. I had some guinea school missing, and had found out that Joseph Boyd had done away with them, and went to church down where Major Mike Reichland goes and said he had got saved. So I, as a minister, I can forgive you if you've done me wrong, and I went up to tell him that I could forgive him for doing away with my guineas, and he says, I didn't do away with them, I killed them. Had his little baby in his arms, and he kind of grinned and smirted a little bit and says, I killed that boy down on the highway. I says, who? He said, that Dawkins boy. I said, Joey, what'd you do that for? He said, he was dating my wife. I said, how do you know? She told me so, and she'd been down there, I'd have killed her too.
During the interview, Hudgens said that this confession came soon after the Dawkins shooting.
What month did this happen when this conversation takes place between you and Joseph Boyd?
I don't remember the month, but about a month after, probably February or March after the boy was killed down on the highway.
Hudgens also told Sutton that Boyd threatened him after he reported this information to the police.
Then rocked on there for a little while, and I don't know where they interviewed him or interviewed her, but he came back down to my house and jumped on to me about that and told me he could get by with anything. He had friends up here. This police department, so whether that's true or not, I don't know.
Are you saying that Joseph Boyd jumped on you, that he learned that you went to the city?
Right.
And he came to your house?
Came to my house, into my yard, yes.
And threatened you?
And basically threatened me, yes.
In what way? I mean, just intimidating and threatening?
Intimidating you and telling me he had friends at the police department. He could do anything he wanted to and get by with it.
After Sutton interviewed Hudgens, he interviewed Joseph Boyd in October 2001. And during that interview, Boyd confirmed that he had had a conversation with Hudgens in which he admitted to killing his guineas.
And exactly what did you tell him about the guineas?
I told him that they were messing with my roosters, and I asked him about it several times, and then he went and got some more, then he went and got a few more, and then one today I come home, fed my roosters, and they were all up there in one pile, and I shot them with my shotgun.
And you told him this?
Yes, sir.
How long, when did you kill his guineas?
It's been about a year and a half ago, somewhere in there.
According to Boyd, though, in this conversation, he did not admit to killing Isaac Dawkins. Moreover, according to Boyd, he didn't even know Isaac Dawkins.
At that time, the conversation that you told him that you killed his guineas, did you tell him you killed Isaac Dawkins?
No, sir.
You didn't tell him that I killed your guineas like I killed Isaac Dawkins or something like that?
No, sir.
You never told him that?
No, sir.
Did you tell anybody you ever done that?
No, sir.
Has anybody ever come to you that said that they bragged about killing Isaac Dawkins?
No, sir.
And you never knew Isaac Dawkins?
No, sir.
And you wouldn't mind taking a polygraph test?
Right on.
And you're telling the truth today?
Yes, sir.
Now, as we said, none of this information was passed over to the defense in advance of trial, so you can imagine what happened when the defense got this information from Hudgens, even though Boyd was denying it. They claimed this was a Brady violation, that the information about Boyd confessing to killing Isaac Dawkins was material exculpatory information, and therefore that Joey Watkins was entitled to a new trial. So the court held a hearing on the matter, and ultimately, though, they denied Joey's motion for a new trial for a few reasons. So first, they found Joey's co-defendant, Mark Free, was represented by the same attorney, that he learned about Hudgens' statement before Free's trial but didn't use it. So as a result, the trial court found, we have the distinct impression that defense counsel determined his testimony, Hudgens' testimony, would not be helpful to the defense in the case. Second, according to the court, Boyd denied either confessing or killing the victim, and the place from which Mr. Hudgens claimed the fatal shot was fired was over a mile away with hilly terrain from the murder scene. And then finally, third, they concluded, quote, Moser found nothing to substantiate any part of Mr. Hudgens' story. Thereafter, Joey Watkins appealed this decision up to the Supreme Court of Georgia, but they ultimately affirmed the lower court's decision, concluding as follows. In assessing Watkins' contention that the state violated Brady v. Maryland by withholding the testimony of James Hudgens, the trial court correctly analyzed the evidence to determine if Watkins carried his burden of showing that 1. The state possessed information favorable to Watkins, 2. Watkins did not possess the evidence, nor could he obtain it with due diligence, 3. The prosecution suppressed the evidence, and 4. A reasonable probability exists that the outcome of trial would have been different had the evidence been disclosed. We find no error in the trial court's determination that Watkins failed to establish the fourth element, and that a review of Hudgens' testimony at the motion for a new trial supports the trial court's assessment that Hudgens' version of events was devoid of credibility when compared to the uncontested and objective evidence established at trial.
So what the court is saying basically was that there was actually no prejudice to Joey by this not being turned over, that there wouldn't have been a difference in the outcome of the trial had this, you know, preacher testified that this other guy confessed to him, right? But in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, it seems like somebody who has a status, a member of the clergy, testifying to something like this would actually seem to carry a lot of weight with the local community, with the jury.
Yeah, I mean, while Boyd denies shooting Isaac Dawkins, he acknowledges he had this conversation with the preacher Hudgens about shooting his guineas. And the question is, why would Hudgens correctly relay that portion of their conversation and yet invent this entire separate confession where Joey Boyd is supposedly confessing to the murder of Isaac Dawkins?
And I mean, come on. Like, if Boyd is being questioned by the police, is he really going to come forward and say, yeah, I did shoot him? I mean, I would assume he would immediately and consistently deny shooting Isaac. But beyond that, I mean, the only way to explain this preacher Hudgens making up something like that would be maybe if he has, like, this ongoing feud with him. He's really angry that he killed his birds. But it's kind of, it's a stretch to me to think that a man of the cloth would do that. But, you know, maybe I'm giving him a little too much credibility.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what the courts hold. And you can see, I mean, I think the key part of their conclusion, which is really the key part of a Brady analysis, is it's not enough just to have exculpatory information. The question is it material? Can it be corroborated? Do we have anything out there to be able to support this claim that someone else confessed to the murder?
Right.
But at least as of a couple of weeks ago, we really didn't have anything to refute that. It was consistent with what the court had said. There was no evidence we could find in any of the files that tended to corroborate Hudgens' story. But then a couple of weeks ago, the Georgia Innocence Project was able to get recordings of an interview done by an investigator hired by Joey's father back in 2004. They had gone missing for years, but they had finally been uncovered. And what we found in the file was this investigator interviewing a man by the name of Tony Selman.
So this man, Tony Selman, knew a young woman named Brianna. And this is not the same Brianna as our Brianne Scarber, who used to date Joey and Isaac. And Selman once let Brianna catch a ride with him to the store. This Brianna, who's also known as Breezy, had gone to Coosa High School, and she was dating Joey Boyd. And the fact that Boyd thought Selman was now seeing Brianna made Boyd furious, and it led him to constantly harassing Selman at his house. Now, at first, this got on Selman's nerves, but things got worse when someone, presumably Boyd, shot the back window of Selman's truck.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it just kind of get on my nerves a little bit, you know?
I bet. Especially after getting your window shot out.
Yeah.
Just trying to get your attention a little bit. Could you tell what shot the window out, whether it was a shotgun, a rifle, or something like that?
Whatever it was, it come through crossways. It hit my window, back window, and come through. It never hit my front window.
It never hit it?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Beyond the fact that Boyd had been coming to Selman's house and harassing him, Selman had another reason to believe that Boyd shot the back window of his truck. He didn't report the shooting to the police. In fact, he had the window fixed the next day. But despite that, here's what he said.
It's like, after that, you know, I seen him somewhere and he said something about my window getting shot out. And I don't even know how, you know what I'm saying? He didn't even have a reason to know that my window got shot out unless something, he'd been involved with it. And I'm not saying he did again. Because I had my window fixed the next day, and I wanted to see if he popped up out of the woodwork saying something about it.
Right.
So given the similarity of this shooting to the Isaac Dawkins shooting, you might have reason to believe that Boyd also shot Dawkins. And according to Selman, people indeed thought that Joey Boyd had killed Isaac Dawkins.
Later on, I heard about Joey's name getting mentioned, you know, after my window got shot out, and I said thank a couple of people. They said, well, you know, a lot of people think he's the one done that.
Selman said that Isaac must have known Brianna.
Brianna knew Isaac?
I'm sure she did. Isaac was, he lived behind me growing up. He was about 3 or 4 years younger than me, I think. And so is Brianna. I'm sure they went to school together. We all went to Coosa.
And Isaac went to Coosa?
Uh-huh.
But did the two date? We haven't been able to get confirmation one way or another. And what about the possibility that Isaac was dating Joey Boyd's ex-wife, which is what Hudgens claimed was a reason that Boyd shot Isaac? Here was Selman's response to an open-ended question about Joey Boyd's possible involvement in the Isaac Dawkins murder.
Do you remember hearing anything else about the murder with Isaac or anything like that? You know, other rumors or what people say when they were talking about Joey Boyd being involved?
About some, was Isaac fooling with Joey's ex-wife?
Well, see, that's what we're trying to find out. I didn't know if it was with Joey's ex-wife that Isaac was seeing Breezy or anything like that. I'm trying to, you know, see if there was any tie there.
I think it was his ex-wife, because I'm pretty sure that, I'm not positive on it, but it seemed like his ex-wife had a few stalking charges on Joey, and Isaac was seeing her, or something to that effect, and maybe I'm getting confused, maybe it was Breezy, but, or Brianna, but I think it was his wife. I don't know if him and Brianna was married, but why prior to him and Brianna getting together?
You know, I don't know anything about Selman or his credibility, but he certainly seems to be saying his recollection is that Isaac Dawkins was either dating Brianna or Joey Boyd's ex-wife. And of course, that is Hudgens' story, that Boyd got wind that Dawkins was dating his ex-wife or possibly his ex-girlfriend, and that's the reason he killed him. And, you know, this is exactly the corroboration that the Georgia courts were looking for to find a Brady violation, and Selman's interview seems to provide. I mean, I don't know how credible he is, but I mean, I don't know, Robbie, what do you think? Is this something where Selman might just be spitballing or something, or do you think there's some real substance to this claim?
I mean, I think it's really hard to determine. And part of the problem I have when I'm like looking at this particular possible suspect is that, I mean, you know, what Selman is relaying, it could also be the result of him having heard rumors, right? Because, you know, things get around town and maybe people heard that this preacher Hudgens had been saying this. And but what kind of frustrates me is that you could be able to better corroborate this or not by actually investigating. You know, the police could have actually investigated what Boyd was doing at the time. Did he have an alibi? Did he own a gun that would have made sense? What about a car? Could he have been connected to a little blue Honda? Like, there's very little actually investigation, or none maybe, that's actually done other than talking to a couple of people and that's it. I don't see any evidence that they actually went out and pursued this as a serious possible lead in Isaac's death. I have no information about what Boyd was doing on January 11, 2000, around 7 o'clock. I don't know what kind of car he owned. And that's the frustration, is that, you know, it's, and Selman, this interview also was done years later with an investigator. It wasn't done around the same time. So it's just like this huge missed opportunity to really gather the kind of evidence that may or may not have corroborated Hudgens' statements.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the problem, is we just have a couple of sentences from Moser, and for whatever reason, Hudgens' information wasn't passed along. So it's just, you know, 3 years later where this private investigator talks to Selman, and now here we are 15, 16 years later and trying to piece together what might have happened. And yeah, it's a loose end out there. I don't know whether it's meaningful. I don't know whether it's meaningless, but certainly we have in this case a preacher coming forward describing a conversation that undoubtedly happened. And the only question we have is, in addition to admitting to killing the Guineas, did Joey Boyd confess to killing Isaac Dawkins? And if he did, was that a legitimate confession, or was that something that maybe was bragging, making something up, hyperbole, etc.?
So apparently food can be serendipitous. Here's why. I'm preparing for the Blue Apron read. I go to my microphone, I press record, and right before I do, Blue Apron sends me the email where they tell me about the food that I'm getting next week. And I open it, and it's got pictures, and I'm just blown away, and I want to share with you guys what they're sending me. First up, it's Mexican beef quesadillas with creamy corn and shishito pepper salsa. Then it's seared chicken and frigola sarda with salsa verde, corn, and tomato. And then finally, last meal is seared salmon and miso soba noodle salad with fairy tale eggplant and baby greens. I get excited when I get those emails because it reminds me how much fun I have cooking the variety of new recipes that Blue Apron sends me. The great thing about those new recipes is they're not repeated within a year. They're created new weekly, so you can choose your meals from a variety of recipes, or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. The other great thing about it is that each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-proportioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. It's a lot of fun, so look, do what I did. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. It's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, it is a better way to cook.
There's also another possibility, which actually seems kind of obvious, and that's this, that this was a road rage situation gone terribly wrong, because it would fit what Wayne Benson saw, and it would fit with all the evidence that we have. If it weren't for Isaac's prior feud with Joey, or the feud that people think they had, I think pretty much everyone would have assumed that this is actually what happened. Because let's start by looking at the information that wasn't disclosed to the defense before Joey's trial.
One of the things Claire was able to obtain was the file from the GBI. That's the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And they're a state-level agency. They don't have first jurisdiction over crimes like this, but they can be called in to help local police departments if they need assistance with forensics or other things they may not have the infrastructure to handle themselves. Now, there's a story there as well about how the GBI got to be involved in Isaac's death. But when Claire finally got the file, she saw what GBI agent James Garman had written on March 9th, 2000. And it says, Mosier stated that information received also indicated that Isaac Dawkins was hot-tempered while driving and possibly became involved in road rage. Mosier advised Dawkins reportedly was involved in many instances as the aggressor while driving on the highway. This information came from friends and co-workers. And in fact, we have a few references to that in Mosier's notes, including a note written on January 25th with one of Isaac's co-workers.
So here are notes from an interview that Detective Mosier had with a co-worker of Isaac's by the name of Donna McCollum on January 25th, 2000. Donna McCollum, via phone, never mentioned any problems with anyone, happy-go-lucky, came in 1 month ago, running late, said coming down Highway 27 behind old man, talked with someone about old man flipped him off, victim impatient, drove too fast.
Yeah, when explaining why Joey had to be the killer, Stanley Sutton had a common refrain. Random shootings don't happen in Rome, Georgia. In New York or Atlanta, sure, but not in Rome. This had to be a personal killing, he said. That's the only type that they got in their neck of the woods. But of course that's not true. Road rage shootings do happen in Rome. There was one not too long after Isaac's death involving a 9mm up on Highway 293. And a man named Wayne Diamond, I spoke to not too long ago, said that in August 2000, he was driving back at night towards the Rome area when he came across a car that was driving pretty slowly, kind of weaving, not driving right. Wayne wanted to get around him, so, you know, he honked, went around the car, passed it, and then they heard a gunshot. His wife actually got shot through the chest, although she didn't realize it at first. She just felt the burning. And when they realized that was a gunshot, they took her to the hospital. Police met them there. But that was it. There was no investigation to be done because random road rage shootings are hard to investigate. And then there's one more example of a road rage shooting happening in Rome.
Yeah, probably the most famous painting by surrealist Salvador Dali is The Persistence of Memory. It's the one with the clocks melting in the sun, and critics have said that what makes the painting so iconic is that we're not used to seeing watches decaying. Dali flips the normal expectation of time as eternal by depicting his clocks decaying. It's the perfect metaphor for the investigation into a man named Heath Wilson as the person who might have killed Isaac Dawkins, because depending upon a matter of mere minutes, he could be the likeliest suspect or the biggest red herring. And the problem is that all we have to go by are a bunch of melted clocks.
On the night of January 11th, 2000, Rome Floyd E911 received a phone call from a motorist. There's this blue Honda, the caller says, and it's speeding, weaving, driving aggressively. You should get someone out here. But this encounter didn't just end with aggressive driving. A few minutes later, the blue Honda fires off two shots, one of which hits the back of a truck. But this is not the truck driven by Isaac Dawkins. On the same night that Isaac was killed, another highway shooting was reported, this time on Highway 20. And the alleged shooter was a man named Heath Wilson from Coosa High School, driving his aunt's 86 Honda Accord. The truck was driven by a man named David McDaniel. Two shots were fired, some were close to the Tannen station on 20, and one hit the left side of its tailgate. A few inches higher, and it would have struck him. And by chance, David McDaniel recognized the driver of the vehicle that was believed to be the shooter, Heath Wilson.
That night, I was in my vehicle, and I was driving down the road, and Ashley was in her car. And we had a car to come up fast from behind us and started flashing the lights and was trying to go from lane to lane, you know, just showing really upset behavior through the window. Car wouldn't go away. It wouldn't go around. It just kind of lingered there with us for a minute, almost like harassing you, you know, just flashing the lights and like road rage real bad. The car would speed up, slow down, speed up, slow down, keep flashing the lights, go to your left side, go to your right side. And, you know, we tried several ways to try to de-escalate the situation, but it seemed like no matter what we did, the person in the vehicle was very irate.
And that's when, you know, a little while later, I noticed a flash. I didn't know what had happened at the time, but it sounded like somebody threw something and hit my vehicle. A few minutes later, we approached town. I remember pulling up to a red light, and at this time, the car had pulled in front of me to the left. Like, just wouldn't go away. There was a truck driver, an 18-wheeler driver, and, you know, I can't remember a lot about that truck, where he was positioned at while we were driving, but I remember that when I pulled in just in front of the GE plant, there was a gas station there. I pulled in, and I remember that the car pulled up, and I remember this 18-wheeler come just barreling out of nowhere. And then this truck driver gets out, and he has a tire tool in his hand. And I see the car pull forward, back up. And anyway, I really feel at that point that that truck driver showing, it was almost like a citizen hero, really, because I really feel that if that truck driver hadn't came to the scene there and showed, like, hey, somebody else is here with this guy, you know, he could see what was going on, that I may have been shot that night.
Again.
Yeah, well, that was before I knew that I even got shot at, you know. It wasn't until later the next day that I actually knew 100% sure that I got shot at.
On Friday, 4 days after Isaac was shot on Highway 27th, Heath was arrested for the Highway 20 shooting.
Officer Adams from the Floyd County Police testified at Heath's trial about the arrest.
I went by the residence and I noted that the vehicle that we were given a lookout on was located at that residence. So I went approximately a half block up the road and observed.
Right. And how long do you reckon you sat there and watched?
Probably about an hour, hour and a half.
Did anything happen after you'd been waiting for about an hour, an hour and a half?
Yeah, it did. After about an hour and a half, I heard gunshots. Well, it was like a semi-automatic weapon being fired.
Okay. And how many shots did you hear?
Probably 10, 12. They appeared to be coming from a field right behind the residence. And I observed two subjects running from that field toward the, it looked like a trailer of the residence.
Could you tell if they were male or female?
Male and female. I could also hear them. She was like screaming about running or something like that.
Is it fair to say that your stress level went up a little bit?
Yeah, raised the hair on the back of my neck, you know, to be honest.
All right. What'd you do?
Well, I got out of the car, yelled the residents and asked them to come outside and basically with their hands over their head. And after doing it about three times, a female subject came outside.
Okay. Did you later find out who this female was?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was apparently his girlfriend or something. When she came out, I asked her where the male subject was. She said inside. I asked her to have him come outside. She walked back to the residence and brought him out. I asked her where the weapon was they were firing. And she said inside. So I asked her to go back inside and get it. She then went inside and brought the weapon back out.
What weapon did she bring?
She brought a .380 caliber. She handed me that weapon and I smelled it. And I asked them if this was the weapon they were firing. And they both stated yes. And it didn't smell like it had been fired.
What'd you do then?
I asked the suspect to have a seat in the vehicle. And as I started talking with her again, I said, this weapon doesn't appear to be fired. Where's the weapon that you all were using? And she stated it was inside. At that time, I asked her to go get it. She brought the weapon out. And when she brought it out, it smelled. You could tell it had been fired. He looked at her and she looked at him. And he said, if anything had happened with that weapon, he said, don't belong to me. He said, it belongs to a friend.
Which didn't.
Well, at that time, one of the investigators called and asked me what caliber weapon was seized at that residence, and I advised him it was a .380 caliber and also a 9mm.
Despite the apparent similarities between the two shootings and Heath's possession of a 9mm, the Rome Police Department almost instantly ruled out Heath Wilson as a suspect in Isaac's murder. An article in the News Tribune a few days after reads as follows. The shot was likely fired while Dawkins was driving, speculated RPD Chief Hubert Smith. I don't want to make any statements that might spook the public, Smith said, but I doubt seriously that we have a nut out here that is randomly shooting. But at this point in time, we don't know what we have. Heath Wilson was ruled out as a suspect in the Highway 27 shooting because he had an alibi. He'd been involved in the shooting on Highway 20 at the time. According to Jim Moser, the timing of the Highway 20 shooting ruled out Heath Wilson as Isaac's shooter. Here's his testimony at Heath Wilson's trial.
Detective Moser, I want to call your attention back to January of the year 2000 and ask if you became involved in the investigation of the murder of Isaac Dawkins.
Yes.
Okay. At some point during your investigation, was there an individual by the name of Heath Wilson who was initially a suspect in that shooting?
No. It wasn't a suspect.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Okay. Can you explain a little further as to why he was not?
Well, at the time that Mr. Dawkins was shot, which you may remember on the 11th of January 2000, was at 7:20 p.m. Approximately the same time, there was an incident on 20 West past Oaknall Cemetery that occurred where there was a, if you will, from what I was advised in my investigation, a road rage incident that occurred right around the same time frame of 7:19 to 7:25. It was during my preliminary investigation into that and that information that the person involved in that incident could not be by any means the same person involved with the shooting of Mr. Dawkins, rather, on 27 South there by Alcan.
Now, let me provide some context for the conclusion being drawn by Detective Moser. The police believe that Heath Wilson shot at David McDaniel on Highway 20, approximately 10 miles northwest, in about a 15-minute drive from where someone shot at Isaac Dawkins on January 11th, 2000. Now, obviously, Detective Moser is saying that the shooting at David McDaniel happened between 7:19 and 7:25 p.m., and given that someone shot at Isaac Dawkins about 7:18, 7:19 p.m., obviously it would be impossible for Heath Wilson to be involved in both shootings if, in fact, the David McDaniel shooting happened between 7:19 and 7:25 p.m. But here's where we start to get into melted clock territory, because when initially there was reporting on the shooting at David McDaniel, the first news article said that shooting took place between 8 and 8:30 p.m., and that's consistent with both the affidavit and the warrant for Heath Wilson's arrest, which also listed the time of the shooting between 8 and 8:30 p.m. It wasn't until later, after police reviewed the handwritten police dispatch logs, that they concluded that the Highway 20 shooting at David McDaniel had actually taken place between 7:19 and 7:25 p.m., thus ruling out Heath Wilson as a suspect in the Isaac Dawkins shooting. But the question remains, are those handwritten logs reliable? Because without the Sally records, the computer printout showing the exact time that all calls were received by E911, we have no way of knowing when those calls were really made. In fact, we believe it's possible that the shooting at David McDaniel actually happened at 7 o'clock or earlier, which would make it feasible that same shooter was involved in the Isaac Dawkins shooting. Obviously, we'll deal with much more in this later, but one thing that we do know for certain is this. Heath Wilson's car. He was driving on January 11th, 2000, a little blue Honda Accord. We believe it's blue. It might be navy blue or black. It's not entirely clear, but it's definitely a little Honda Accord. We know from the police notes that Detective Moser and Lieutenant Burnett went out to a lot where Heath Wilson's Honda had been towed, and they took pictures of it. But for some reason, those pictures were never shown to Wayne Benson, the eyewitness to the Isaac Dawkins shooting. He was shown a whole photo album full of photographs of hundreds of cars, but he was never shown Heath Wilson's Honda Accord.
They showed him pretty much every other single small, bluish, foreign-make car in basically all of Floyd County, except for the one that was definitely involved in a shooting that night.
It's amazing. It actually took me quite a long time to figure that out, because I had such a strong assumption that they would have shown him the car. And I'm really floored that they never did. And how they had the pictures. These pictures were taken by Detective Moser.
That's what
not
I asked. Moser
by
took
Floyd
them.
County PD.
So there's no reason to take photos but for the Isaac Dawkins investigation.
Right. But they still didn't show them to him. I don't understand it.
When we interviewed Mr. Benson, that's one thing we wanted to do. Without telling him what the photos were, show him photos of Heath's car, and just see if it looked anything like the car he'd seen that night. Mr. Benson agreed to meet with us, although he expressed to us from the start that Based on everything he'd heard about the case, he firmly believed in Joey's guilt. And although willing to answer our questions, he warns at the outset that we were wasting our time, that he knew nothing that could help Joey, and Joey was already where he belonged. But if we really wanted to hear what he had to say, he'd speak to us. He didn't necessarily agree with our goals or what we were looking into, but he thought it was only fair to let us know what he remembered. And towards the end of the interview with Wayne Benson, Larry Davis, the private investigator assisting the GIP, showed Benson pictures of Heath's car, and his reaction was not at all what we expected.
While we were interviewing Mr. Benson, and a little bit after we showed him the photos that we just got today, actually, after we had to call 911 to get into the police station to get the documents we had an appointment to pick up, that while he was looking at the photos, not right at the start, a little bit later on, he had kind of like this, not quite a grin, kind of like a wry smile, sort of. But definitely a smile.
I didn't know what to make of it. I mean, at the time, I was just like, what is going through his head? Is he thinking about something completely not related to this? But then, shortly after that, he's like, I see what you guys are doing. You're getting me in a loophole here. He was holding the pictures of Heath Wilson's car, looking at them very closely when he was doing that, and when he was saying about the loophole.
I'm not sure what kind of loophole Mr. Benson thought we'd found, or why exactly the photos caused him to smile, but he told us that, yes, the car in those photos was similar to the one he'd seen that night.
The thing that was most fascinating me, and I was like, I was so nervous about him looking at the car that I couldn't even give it to him. I wanted you to give it to him. But I mean, from the minute he looked at these pictures of Heath Wilson's car, he was like, well, that looks similar to what I saw. I mean, there wasn't like any hemming and hawing. I mean, he stared deeply.
He did. I was very happy to see that. I was concerned as well that he was going to take the first picture and immediately dismiss it and say, no, that's nothing like the car that I saw.
He kind of did a double take.
He did. The fact that the issue of the antenna, the way that he had described it as being unusual, and then seeing the antenna on the front portion of Heath Wilson's vehicle, that he now concluding that very well could have been the antenna that he saw and remembered as being unusual, says a lot. The other thing, of course, that struck me is that he was never shown these photographs.
Right.
He was shown hundreds of other pictures, and yet, photographs of a vehicle that they knew had been involved in another shooting was not shown to an eyewitness. That seemed very unusual to me.
Yeah, and Susan, I want to definitely make sure we're highlighting the importance of this. It's my understanding, right, that back in 2000, 2001, Wayne Benson was shown pictures of hundreds of cars and said none of them really looked anything like the car that he saw involved in the Isaac Dawkins shooting. And it was a completely different reaction when he was shown Heath Wilson's car, right?
I mean, I don't know if it's hundreds, but I've seen the photo album they showed Mr. Benson. And it's pretty substantial. It's a complete notebook of little bluish small cars. But there wasn't an Accord of this year or around that year in the book. And the only one that Mr. Benson had flagged as even being possibly close to the car he had seen is actually the closest one in the book to Heath Wilson's car.
Am I the only one whose mind is boggled that you have another shooting that same night and that person's car, like the picture of that person's car, that suspect, is not shown to the one witness who could have identified it? It just seems like a huge lapse in the investigation.
Like Colin said, though, this could also just be the biggest red herring in the history of cases. Because yes, it all seems to match up. It's a little blue Honda that looks like the one that shot Isaac, by someone who was arrested a few days later with a gun, a 9mm. And his statement to the cops at the time of his arrest was, if something bad happened with that weapon, it did not belong to me. It belonged to a friend at work. Obviously, you're gonna look at this guy as suspect. And the cops did. The problem is, they decided that the shooting on Highway 20 happened essentially the exact same time as a Highway 27 shooting. And those locations are too far apart for Heath Wilson to have been at both.
And the two locations are, for point of reference, about 10 miles apart. And if you look at Google Maps, at least in 2016, they say the drive between the Highway 27 shooting and the Highway 20 shooting is about 15, 16 minutes. So, that's where things stood after 7 weeks of investigation into the death of Isaac Dawkins. The Rome Police Department had written off Joy Watkins as a viable suspect, and they had several possibly viable leads into the identity of the person who took Isaac's life. But things were about to take a drastic turn, and that's because there was a new sheriff in town. At the behest of Isaac's family, Sheriff Stanley Sutton of the Floyd County Police Department took over, and he had a markedly different way of approaching the case. Next time on Undisclosed.
Episode 7 is in the books. Thanks for coming along for the ride, everyone. And here come the credits. As always, our thanks to the Georgia Innocence Project for bringing us Joey's case. Find out more at www.georgiainnocenceproject.org. Much love to our three great sponsors. Casper, thank you so much for the mattress. We are really enjoying it here in the Robinson household. Audible, and of course, don't forget, you can get a 30-day free trial and a free audiobook at audible.com/undisclosed. And our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. I want to thank you, the fans, especially the ones that have voted for the Undisclosed panel at South by Southwest. Folks, you can continue to vote for us up until September 2nd at the following URL. Bear with me. It's a little bit funky. Here it comes. www.panelpicker.sxsw.com/vote/67597. Or you could just go to the Undisclosed Twitter, Instagram, Facebook pages and find the link there. Might be easier than trying to type in that URL. The folks that make Undisclosed behind the scenes, here they come. Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez with the theme music, Baluki with the logo, Nina Mooser and Christy Williams with the website. Don't forget, you can check out that website at www.undisclosed-podcast.com. Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the podcast Crime Writers On is our producer. She gets help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings. Don't forget, Brooke's podcast, Actual Innocence. It's great. Go listen. Methil Telhan is the producer of everything. Here's your friendly weekly reminder to go ask Mr. John Cryer questions at the Undisclosed Addendum. All you got to do is tweet or Instagram him with the hashtag UDAddendum. Ask case questions. Hopefully, we'll read them on the show. Otherwise, get at us on the social medias. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at our handle, at UndisclosedPod, and drive the discussion using the hashtag Undisclosed. Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to your continued listenership next week for episode 8. Until then,